Welcome to Horror 101, a special series celebrating some of the most influential films from the horror genre. Tonight, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We begin with John Kenneth Muir, an accomplished author and critic, and one of our favorite guests. You can check out his library of books on films of all genres at johnkennethmuir.com and read his enlightening criticism at reflectionsonfilmandtelevision.blogspot.com.
The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of five youths, in particular Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother Franklin. It is all the more tragic in that they were young. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day. For them, an idyllic summer afternoon drive became a nightmare. The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Texas Chainsaw, I told you last conversation we had, is the most terrifying experience that I've ever had. I mean, if I put it in my DVD player now, my hands are shaking just putting the disc in the tray. But I think there's such artistry in it that a lot of people don't recognize. Tell me about your impressions of that film. I mean, and how it fits the mood of the times. I mean, it's pretty bleak, the film, obviously.
It is amazingly bleak. And, you know, how I see the film, contextually, it's part of what I didn't make up this term. It was used before me, but I like to use it because I think it's a good moniker for it. It's the savage cinema. It's part and parcel that savage cinema of the early 1970s. And we associate titles like Straw Dogs, Clockwork Orange, Kubrick, Last House on the Left, and Deliverance as sort of being part of that movement, which is that the horror arises in those films from the random application of sort of cruel fate. It's not because there's a monster. It's not necessarily because of psychology either. I mean, yeah, psychologists can have a field day with the killers in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it's not their psychologies that's at issue. It's something else. It's like I said, it's the application of cruel and random fate, and how that plays on the people in the film. I mean, what you get in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is this depiction of what I consider a sort of uncaring, disordered cosmos. I mean, again, I know a lot of horror fans get very upset when you do talk specifically about politics, but a lot of horror films do come from a leftist point of view. I'm sorry if that offends conservatives, but it's true. And this is a movie that says, you know what, if there is a God, that God is uncaring, and we're just like ants on the landscape. And you see that idea reinforced by how many shots of disorder there are in the film and how many shots of like the characters as like unimportant players in the landscape. There's this great shot in the film. I don't know how far back it was shot, but it's a long exterior establishing shot. It's when the van picks up the hitchhiker and there's like a tree, but it's like almost all sky. I mean, the van life will be an ant on the landscape. It's saying humanity is unimportant. And as far as disorder, you have that sort of disgust through the dialogue where, you know, astrology is made to seem, you know, certainly on a level with, you know, another religion. They talk about malefic forces, I believe, occurring. And, you know, another one of the horoscopes reads, you will have a disturbing and unpredictable day or something like that. You know, it's the idea that if there is something up there watching over us, it either doesn't give a damn about us or is playing with us. It's not a benevolent God. And so the world in the film is just all disorder. I mean, it opens with these discordant musical cues and these flash shots of a corpse. And you don't know what's happening with the corpse, but then you finally get the shot of the corpse propped up out of the grave, sort of like a scarecrow almost. And that's a view of disorder. That's the dead should be buried, not, you know, perched on top of their graves. You know, and then there's another view of disorder. There's an upside-down armadillo on the road. You know, roadkill. It's not supposed to be dead on the road with its feet up. It's supposed to be walking across the street. You know, again and again we get this. And our expectations are confounded again and again. There's a spider web inside the house. It's taken over where humans are supposed to dwell. The characters talk about going to a watering hole. Well, it's dry. They go to get gas. There's no gas. You know, again and again, the world is disordered. There's just something cosmically wrong going on here. You know, death has risen with that scarecrow, and everything is out of place and disorder. And talking about sort of the economic and social context for the film, you have to think about what was happening in the early 70s. Okay, Nixon was president. We had a recession. There was the energy crisis. There was all this kind of stuff going on there. You know, there was the high prices for gas. The pillar of faith in government was being shattered because of Watergate. Things just were not looking good. And you know, unemployment meant that the people, the Sawyer family, the killers in the film, were laid off from their jobs at the slaughterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So because they had no income, they improvised. And boy, did they improvise. Okay, let's make furniture made out of human bones, since we have human bones available. We can't afford the groceries. Well, we're going to eat people. You know, we're going to make do with what we have. You know, and that's sort of very much what the film is about. You know, people have described the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, very aptly as sort of America out of gas, you know, and that seems to be the case, where America is out of gas and the people seem to actually be feeding on themselves in a way, or feeding on each other. And so that's very much, the larger context for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And so, you know, again, you couple those things together and you think, if there is a God, he's not looking after us. And look at all the bad things that are happening to us. You know, it's a very cruel and almost nasty world.
You're so much more articulate about it than I can be. But and it goes into what you're saying. What always terrified me about the movie is these kids exist in their own kind of bubble. And as you said, when they're speaking about astrology, and you know, you have an unpredictable day ahead of you, and I mean, they're probably curious about what exists outside of that bubble. But then when they reach the farmhouse, I mean, what's scary to me is how their lives can irrevocably change on the turn of a dime. I mean,
right.
it's that element that terrifies me.
Yes, you got it exactly. That's it totally. It's the application of cruel and unexpected fate. It's the idea that in horror you can be driving down the road and you have a right turn and a left turn, and both look absolutely innocuous. But if you take the left turn, you're going to be fine. You're going to go to the restaurant you want to go to and make it to your destination. But if at this one juncture, this one instant in all of time, you take the other road, you're going to flip the car, and the person who's going to rescue you is going to be a cannibal, and he's going to cut you up. You know? There's no reason for that. But this gets at something very important about the nature of human existence. We don't get the answer as to why that happens. Why, if I took that road, does that happen to me? I mean, we face this all the time. Why do planes crash? I mean, we know why planes crash. It's a mechanical failure. But I guess what I'm saying is, why is one of our loved ones on that plane the day that mechanical failure occurs? You know, that's the thing. That's the crux of it. That's the fulcrum of the savage cinema, the revolution,
the randomness
orbit
of it.
Yes,
yeah.
Around that idea. You know, and that's a very powerful idea, because that's an idea that we can't reconcile. That's the kind of idea that'll keep you up at night. Why did the person I love, you know, get sick? Why did they get cancer? They didn't smoke. Look, that guy next door smoked for 40 years, but my dad gets lung cancer. He never smoked a day in his life. You know, why? Why?
Yeah.
And these horror movies, these savage cinema horror movies, really orbit that question. They make you aware of that idea of why. Why did fate single me out for this? And there is no answer. And that is terrifying. And that's why I say that horror movies really grapple with questions of human existence and questions of human nature and the human spirit. They make us very uncomfortable because they ask us those questions that mainstream movies don't want to ask because they don't want to make us uncomfortable. I remember there was a movie that was lauded in the late 1980s about racism. It was called Mississippi Burning. Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe were in it. And at one point in the film, I groaned because the sort of answer to it, they said, "Why does this happen?" And the line, which I've never forgotten, is, "Maybe we're all bad." You know, it's like, man, the mainstream movies just reduce it to pablum. You know, they just reduce it. And everybody loved that movie. Yeah, maybe we're all bad. No. It's not really countenancing anything. It's dismissing it. That kind of thing is just dismissing the issue. Let's really look at it. Why? Why is there racism? Why? It's because what? Because we fear the other? Because, you know, you can go into all these reasons, but mainstream movies do not. They'll give you little sound bites that comfort you. Horror movies do the opposite thing. They intentionally discomfort you. And that's what the Texas Chainsaw Massacre does in spades, because it's about these, you know, seemingly normal kids going along in their bubble who have a really bad day, and it's the last day of their lives. And God doesn't care, and nobody cares. You know, that's the thing. And a little earlier, we talked about, you know, the movies that shatter tradition, shatter movie decorum, are sort of the best horror movies. And I think the reason that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre works so much is not just that it's about this, about the cruel application of random fate, but because of the way the movie is structured. You know, it's not so much what Tobe Hooper has added in the film, it's what he has subtracted. He has subtracted one of the most important ideas of narrative filmmaking in 100 years of filmmaking, and that is the idea of learning. That in a three-act structure, you're going to have a character who undergoes some sort of adventure or crisis, and along the way, he or she learns. And even in terms of Psycho, a very revolutionary film, the learning is transferred. It goes from Marion Crane to the detective Arbogast and then to Vera Miles. The plot line and direction towards understanding is maintained right till the end, so we get the psychiatrist restore order. In the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, we are deprived of learning. Each character walks into that house and gets clobbered over the head or put on a meat hook or whatever, and there's no learning. The other characters don't learn a thing.
They walk in just as unsuspecting as the teenager before them,
There is no second act in that film, and it's brilliant. Mm. It says there's no learning in life. I mean, do we always have learning in life? No, we don't. And that's part of the reason the film is so universally affecting. It doesn't mirror movie convention. It mirrors real life in a very disturbing way. You know, again, there's sort of no heroes. You know, people just walk in and get killed. You know, the alpha males of the group get killed first or in relatively short order anyway. And so there's nobody to carry water for us as identification points. I mean, the film does a lot of very indecorous things with the characters. It treats the handicapped character, Franklin, like a joke, an object of humor. I mean, it's very nasty. It's very nasty. I mean, he's treated as an absolutely kind of horrible person, you know, and terrible indignities happen to him. You would never see that in a studio-made film today, a handicapped person treated poorly like that, unless you wanted to make the people who were treating him that way, like, you know, some sort of supervillains or something. You would never see that happen. You would never see a character pushed by the wind down a hill while he's peeing in a wheelchair and falling onto the ground. You'd never see that. Again, that's random fate cruelly applied, and that's what Hooper is all about. And so the characters have no learning. We don't learn anything from them, and it becomes this just almost surreal but very affecting nightmare.
I'm sorry. It's also because we had had several years of Vietnam and we were bombarded with images of, you know, our children go off to a foreign unknown world and they come back in body bags, and there's no reason for it.
Right. And it's also a development of, you know, what I call the easy rider principle. It's saying, you know, don't go down into the South. You know what I'm saying? don't go to Texas, man, because they're going to blow your ass away. You know, there's a development of that as well. You know, the sort of regional fear of, you know, what's happening in Texas? Well, you know, what's happening in the South? What, you know, what's going on? You know, not you know, it's about taking a wrong turn into terror. And that wrong turn, you know, could be hillbillyism, you know, which we see in sort of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. It could be, I mean, my God, it could be, you know, cannibalism in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just very much about that. It's about driving face first into horror and not knowing you're going there. And
The Hills Have Eyes is similar, correct?
The Hills Have Eyes, exactly. Yeah. Another film that I love, and another film of the savage cinema that gets at the same thing. A family decides to go check out some land in the desert, and they bring all of the comforts and conveniences of modern society with them, and they think those things will protect them. But there are people who want what they have more than they do, who are willing to break tradition, break decorum, break morality to get those things, to kill, to own those things. Meanwhile, the mom is, you know, setting out napkins and silverware in the desert, you know. Right? You know? And it's not until her children realize that the old rules don't apply here and put her corpse out as a lure, breaking decorum again, that they are able to defeat Papa Jupe and his gang of bad guys. They mm-hmm. have to let go of the culture that gave them the modern conveniences, and they have to let go of the traditions, like they all pray before the meal. They have to let go of all that to beat these people who are sort of more primal people of nature. You know, and again, it's a battle of the haves and the have-nots. And what's fascinating, of course, is that the film came out in the Carter administration. The family is named Carter. You know, You know, it's just very interesting. You know, and Wes Craven called them, you know, a white bread family. And you know, it's two families in opposition, both trying to stay alive, both fighting over the same piece of ground. But again, savage cinema, they drive into it not knowing that that's going to happen. And those are the kind of horror movies I like. I would never demean anybody who enjoys horror movies. And there are many people who really, really love the horror movies of the 30s and 40s and really groove on the monsters, on the Wolfman, the Mummy, Frankenstein mm-hmm. monster, Dracula. Great. I love that people love those because those things represent things too. Those things represent being the outsider, being a disdained other. All these other things are encoded in that. And I think that's great. I love that people love those films. My personal taste, I guess, is what I'm saying, is these sort of savage cinema films. I guess because the idea that appeals to me is an idea that I relate to my life, is that, you know, we don't always know why things happen. And, you know, why is it, you know, one day we're going fine and then, you know, we get a flat tire, you know? Mm-hmm. It's horror movie, taking on that sort of, you know, existential idea of of why are our lives the way they are? Why do terrible things happen to good people, and things like that? And to me, that's just the idea I very much groove on in these films. And a lot of people who know me say, "Oh, but you're such a nice person. How can you like these horribly violent films?" And, you know, I say, you know, my answer, you know, is just simple: is that these films are countenancing what real life is about. I mean, that sounds like a dark view. I don't think life is all danger and destruction around every turn, but it captures some essential component of life that resonates with me, I guess, is what I'm saying. So I very much like these films from, you know, the late 60s through the 70s, you know, like Texas Chainsaw, like Hills Have Eyes, like Last House on the Left, like Deliverance, you know, that kind of thing. They're just, you know, very interesting films about people who fall headfirst into horror and kind of have to cope with what they've got and what's available and deal with things they could never imagine. And what it does is it changes their – if they survive, it changes their whole existence, you know.
Exactly.
It's almost a catharsis, you know. You have to run this gauntlet and do things you never thought you would do, like use your mother's corpse as a decoy or you know, lock yourself in a basement and, you know, shoot people and zombies and that. You know, it's sort of saying, you know what? We have this sort of easy, leisurely life here in America, and we've had for years and years. You know, we take running water for granted. We take electricity for granted. You know, what are we today? What are we? And these films say, all things being equal, it's not always going to be that way. And, you know, to survive, if you're just a product of that culture, you're not going to make it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting.
What happened was true. The most bizarre and brutal series of crimes in America.
Our guest tonight is one of the most accomplished and talented cinematographers in the business. So accomplished and talented, in fact, that three of his works have found their way into the Museum of Modern Art, including his very first feature film effort, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. In addition to his unforgettable work in feature films, including the 2003 remake of Chainsaw Massacre and the upcoming Christmas Day release of Alien vs. Predator Requiem.
I'll be there that morning.
That's right.
You think I'm joking. I'm not.
That's what Christmas is all about. He has long been a leading innovator of the music video landscape, lending his considerable talents to many hundreds of works, from The Police's Every Breath You Take to Michael Jackson's Billie Jean to Janet Jackson's All For You. It's a legendary cinematographer we have here tonight. He's received a plethora of prestigious awards and honors, including the Kodak Vision Hall of Fame Award for Music Video Cinematography, the Music Video Producers Association Lifetime Achievement Award, and the AICP Best Commercial Cinematography Award for his work on the now classic Motorola Wings ad, which incidentally is another one of his works to be included in the Museum of Modern Art.
Oh.
It is a tremendous honor for us to welcome cinematographer Daniel Pearl to our show. Mr. Pearl, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Jeremy, David, horror fans. I want to say a special hello to someone out there, my daughter, Nikki.
Oh, great, great.
Oh,
well,
awesome.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's a great honor to speak with you, and I'm not kidding. This the original Chainsaw Massacre, absolutely. I feel like it changed my life, and I'm sure you get that quite a lot from rabid fans out there. But I was surprised to learn, or actually not quite surprised, but you were right out of college when the opportunity to shoot Texas Chainsaw came about, weren't you?
That's correct. You know, at the time, I started in the film school in about 68. And at that time, they told us, and it was true at the time, that there were very few opportunities to actually break into the film business.
Yeah.
So if you were passionate about the cinema, if this is what you love, really what you would do is get your undergraduate degree, go on and get a graduate degree, eventually become a professor, teach films, and hopefully you get to make films on the weekends or in the summers and get a grant. I was pursuing that path. I got both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree at the University of Texas. And right as I finished my master's degree, I told my close friends, we were all making student films together. I said, you know, guys, I actually think that I might be able to crack it and get into this business. I think I could shoot a film by the time I'm 35. I was 23 at the time. And about 3 weeks later, Toby Hooper called me up and offered me to shoot what was known at that time as Leatherface, but became the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Wow. That's quite something right there. I know the picture was made pretty on a pretty shoestring budget, but were there a lot of discussions on the visual look of the picture prior to shooting?
Well, yeah. I mean, Toby and I talked about it a lot throughout. You know, we're both doing, you know, he had a look, and I had, you know, he basically hired me because he liked the way some of the commercials that I had shot for students who had already graduated. I'd done a few commercial jobs, and, you know, it just worked out. We got together, we started talking about it. Some of it had to do with the situation. You have to keep in mind, as a cinematographer, 23 years old, I thought I knew a lot. I didn't really know as much as I thought, but there's a lot of intuition there that comes to play in the look of the movie and especially the designing of the shots and the compositions.
Yeah, and a lot of people comment on the documentary feel of it. I mean, it absolutely feels real and authentic at every moment.
This is absolutely true, you know, and it was essential to Toby that we shoot with his handheld style. And at that time, for the film buffs out there, they had only just recently, about a year prior to that, invented lightweight 35mm cameras that were quiet enough to shoot with sync sound. So we tried for those. We were a very small budget, as you said, a shoestring budget. Our budget, in fact, believe it or not, was $80,000.
Oh,
we got that film in the can and partway through the lab for $80,000.
Wow.
Mm. Anyhow, we chose to shoot 16. I have to say that some of it might actually be a bit of chance, you know, me, or a bit of luck that I didn't know that much. I wasn't that sophisticated of a lighter. I didn't know that much about it at the time. And so that probably also helps give it that documentary and verite feel.
Yeah.
You know, as you probably know, I shot the remake in 2002, and I went very different there. You know, I went for a totally different look and tried to give it much more of a look and a style that I thought would be appealing to what I consider now sort of be the MTV viewing audience.
That's true, and I definitely want to talk to you about that one, because the visuals in the remake as well are you know, it sounds strange because you're talking about the horror genre, but they're gorgeous, your photography in that remake as well.
Thank you.
But in terms of the original, were there cinematic inspirations that you looked to, that you and Toby looked through to draw upon?
Well, you know, this is before VCRs and things like that, so that wasn't as easy as it is today.
Yeah.
Today, reference. In fact, in my opinion, there's probably too much referencing of other works.
Yeah.
But you know,
movies are like that now.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Whole movies are like that now, or just like scenes from other movies. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, that's just become very much, because it's so easy now to get your hands and lay it, you know, and have a look at whatever. You know, it's instantaneous. This is the world we live in. So those days, the VCR hadn't been invented. You had to be lucky enough to be in a place where they were showing a film if you wanted to see it. That was your only chance.
Right. Now tell me about the two most famous shots, or at least the two most impressive ones for me in the film.
Huh?
And of course, the first one, it has to be the dolly track under the swing, where you follow the girl into the house after Kirk has, you know, taken a beating. How did that shot come about? That was not pre-planned, was it?
No, it's quite an interesting thing. We had shot for 1 week. You know, we were young filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of imagination. Fortunately, we had good intuition. But, you know, still, we're beginning filmmakers. It was declared by the producers after 5 days of shooting that we weren't moving quite fast enough for them, and that they shut us down for 1 week and instructed Toby to write a shot list. They wanted a complete shot list of every shot that was going to be made in the whole movie. Therefore, they could schedule a shooting and basically put us on a... do a giant math problem and put us on a schedule to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Unbeknownst to me, Toby did that, but it was just sort of as a placebo. It wasn't really a real shot list, which became apparent to me about a half a day into it and to the producers about 2 days into it. Now, this brings us to the third day we're back, and it's the day we're shooting that scene, exterior behind the swing. We shoot the whole scene, and as we finish it, I get this idea. I go, Toby, you know, that we have a dolly track that we basically have a platform dolly, which is, you know, for those of you out there, it's a track, kind of like a railroad track, like your train tracks that you might have had when you had a model train set. Bigger scale, it's probably about 32 inches wide and about 2-inch diameter pipe. I had 60 feet of that track. The whole film was made with just 60 feet of track. And I realized that I could lay down on that platform, hold my 16-millimeter camera off the edge, the front edge of the platform, I had a hard line because we're shooting one letterbox aspect ratio of 1.85 width to height ratio. Mm-hmm. I have a hard line at the bottom that I knew I could, that I, if I tilted the camera up and didn't show the track, that I could fit underneath the swing. So I described this shot to Toby. He said, you know, it'd be a great shot. Terry McMinn will look fantastic from behind like this. And as we dolly in, the house will grow and grow and grow on this 8-millimeter, which is a fairly wide-angle lens. Not extreme, but definitely a wide-angle lens.
Yeah.
The house will grow and grow and grow until basically it just envelops the frame.
And
Toby
that,
goes.
And that is why that shot is so terrific. Not
exactly.
not just because of the technological aspect of it.
Right.
But
no.
Thematically, yeah, it works for the scene.
Absolutely about that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Toby, he got almost starry-eyed. He goes, damn.
I bet.
That's just it, you know. So set up to do it, right? Well, the production, about 15 minutes into making the set, I think, what are you guys doing? Well, you know, we're making, you don't have another shot on the list, move on, it's not on the list, you got to move. Toby, God bless him, says, guys, I'm the director, he's the DP, you step out of my way, you cannot stop us, we're making a shot. They fire us while we're doing it. But we're making a shot because it's too important to the movie. You cannot stop it.
And thank goodness he did, because, I mean, 30 years later, we're still talking about it.
You know, people, I'm very proud of that shot. You know, I've been introduced. Someone introduced me back when Spielberg was doing 1941. Somebody introduced me to him, and he went, Daniel Pearl, you shot the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Put his arm around me, started leading me off the set, walking away from his set that he was shooting on, and started asking me, how'd you come up with that idea for that dolly under the swing? It's incredible.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's something else. Another thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of a particular shot in the film, and this might come from the kind of experimentation that you were doing on this film, the shot at nighttime, the car, where the father is beating the hitchhiker in front of the lights of the car.
Thank you.
just incredible shot.
Thank you. I'm very proud of that, and that's, you know, you can trace that right through to the kind of stuff I'm shooting today. I'm still doing that same kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
It, you know, you got a bit of something in the atmosphere, whether it be dust or haze or fog or you know, whatever. In that case, it's dust. You know, and it just becomes very strong and graphic, and, you know, and a lot about, you know, if you think about it, things that are kind of scary, and if you don't see things too clearly, they're scarier, they're more interesting, and you as a viewer, you contribute, you participate, you fill in the blanks on what you can't quite see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the technique that we use throughout the film, and that's just one of the places where we've done it.
Yeah, amazing, amazing work. Now, when you're doing it, could you feel on the set that this was going to be something something special, something that worked?
I have to say that when I read the screenplay, I was absolutely mind blown. I could not believe that I was being asked to be involved in something like this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't believe that ultimately I would shoot it. I thought it would go away. And after I read the screenplay the first time, I called Toby back. I tried to play cool. Of course, I'm like, you know, electrified. I can't even believe that this opportunity has come my way. I'm 12 years ahead of my schedule.
Yeah.
35, right?
Right.
Yeah. And when I shot my first picture. So I tried to play it cool with Toby. I said, Toby, so when do we start? He goes, well, Daniel, he goes, I got an $80,000 budget, and at the moment I have $70,000 from one backer. And as soon as we get the other $10,000, we start, right? So we're living in Texas, and there's, you know, some people, sometimes pretty wealthy people in Texas at this time.
Right.
And so I hung up the phone. I'm going, oh, my God, this movie is too good on paper. They'll get a guy from Hollywood out here. I'll lose this job. I had a friend, wealthy guy, who was a film buff. I called him up. I asked him I told him I'd been asked to shoot a film. Would he like to read the screenplay? He did. He called me back 3 hours later. He loved it. He put up the money, and away we went.
Oh, wow.
So now, to more directly answer your question, it's an interesting story. I felt like I was compelled to tell it to you guys. I hope you don't mind. But to more directly answer, you have no way to estimate that anything is quite as big as this. You know, that's going right into the Museum of Modern Art that people are going to be talking about it 34 years later, right?
Yeah.
No, there's just no way to estimate that. If you did, you probably wouldn't believe it if you thought that to yourself. So, I mean, we thought it was good. We thought it was great. We thought it was interesting. And you know what else? We thought it was funny.
It is funny, yeah, and you don't get that until repeat viewings. I mean, obviously, you're so preoccupied with just being terrified by it when you first watch it, but the humor is something that does come across the more times you watch it.
Yeah, no, it's totally meant to be humorous.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, the same crew, the next job we had after this, we got hired to shoot a commercial for the state of Texas that Don't Drink and Drive. Supposed to be at the scene of a accident. We arrive afterwards, and the whole thing, you see this ambulance pulls up, and there's all these cuts of the accident scene, and in the end, it tilts down, you see martini glass on the ground. Well, when we shot it, we used so much blood and shot it with blood spurting out of veins and things like that. The Texas Department of Public Safety said, "Y'all sick. You guys are all sick." "We can't put this on television. We're all going like, wow, what are you talking about? This?" You know, so it was pretty intense to make it, but we definitely got into the mode and, you know,
so,
got on it.
So I know the remake, the 2002 remake, it was directed by a longtime collaborator of yours, Marcus Nespo.
Correct.
Now when he approached you to do it, were you apprehensive at all?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. Around that time in my life, my daughter would have been 15 years old, right? And I actually, at about 3 years earlier, that saying, well, you know, I have a different take on life now. I'm a father, I have a daughter, and I'm not sure I'd make that movie if it was offered to me today, right? And I've been saying that on panels that I've been on. You know, I said, yeah, you know, I enjoy doing it. It's great fun to shoot it, but I'm just not sure that, you know, I would make that film today.
Right.
Well, then I get this call from Marcus, and as you said, yeah, I've been shooting a lot with Marcus for probably 8-9 years before that. He had He had heard many Texas Chainsaw Massacre stories. I had no idea he was even up for the job. He called me up. I was shooting a music video in Montreal, and my cell phone rang. It was Marcus. He goes, "Listen, I just signed on to shoot the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Will you shoot it for me?" And right away I said yes. And then I thought, why did I just say yes? I've been telling people I wouldn't do this if it came up again. But he's a great filmmaker, a great guy to collaborate with. I knew he would make a great film, and I knew together we would really do a good job of it.
Yeah. Well, when you said that you wanted to take a completely different approach from what you did on the original, what exactly was involved with that? What was your vision for the look of this one?
Well, you know, it's kind of strange. Obviously, it's funny because I was interviewed many times, and in fact, the producer said the same thing to me as we were ramping up the production and I was on prep. They went, you know, well, so it's going to be gritty and grainy like the original. And I went, no. I mean, what do you mean, no? And I'm going, well, guys, you know, I've done that. And really, this is also something that Marcus Nispel knew. He knew that I'd done that. He knew that I was the one cinematographer that could remake this film without trying to knock off the original. Because I'd done that. I didn't need to do it. Right? So we came up with this other visual approach. Now, as much as anything else, there's just an angle of light that I like. I'm a cross lighter. I like to lift texture and things and play with not so much fill, keep it contrasty, keep it dramatic.
Yeah.
Graphic compositions, graphic light, lighting with smoke. So in a way, I do what I did. Okay? I did what I do. Right? And that's the style. But at the same time, it's also, as much as anything else, it's tempered by the schedule that we're on. And so I do what I do to the best of my ability with the time that I have to get it done in. And it's really, it's hard for me to talk about in terms of a style because it's not born out of any other film or anything else that I've seen. It's just kind of the natural sort of feeling that I have about light, where light should be placed. And it's pretty straightforward.
And it's interesting how you say that it's not predicated on the look of any other films, because that's what I was taken by when I saw the remake that you shot, and now I'm taken by how every similar movie tries to emulate that look that you created.
Yes, they do. I know.
Yeah.
That's flattering, you know, and that. But you know, the way I say it, and I hope we don't get bleeped or shut down for it, but you know, I don't like to refer to films. I'll refer a little bit to films I've made, but still don't beat that to death.
Right.
But films that other people have made, because I prefer to think that my work comes from my head or my heart and not from my ass. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the film, I'm not schooled on cinematic terminology, so forgive me. But the color scheme seems to be very kind of seeped in kind of tobacco hues. And
yeah, that's some brilliant work there by a production designer, Greg Blair, who, you know, got in there. Excellent locations. I'm sorry I don't actually know the location scout's name, but he found us fantastic locations that were actually have been selected prior to me even coming on board the picture. And that just helps set a tone. It just looks great, you know. Texas is good. You come here, you got some humidity, you get, you know, things get funky to get a patina on them just naturally with age. You know, it's kind of like, it's not quite as good as New Orleans, but it's a place that just gets, as things get old, they just take on a texture and a color, and it's fantastic for, you know, for film.
Yeah, and Texas has really blossomed in terms of film production.
Absolutely.
Yeah, big time.
I'm actually here at the moment in Texas.
Oh, yeah. You're did you grow up in Texas? Is that where you're from originally? Or?
In 2 days, I start another film here.
Oh, wow. I want to talk to you a little bit about your other work before we wrap this up. But music videos, you've made such an indelible impression with your work in music videos. And I see today, and I'm sure everyone else does too, how music videos have kind of integrated themselves into feature films. The fast cutting, just nonstop kind of gorgeous imagery. Do you find that this is a double-edged sword, or do you think it's entirely a good development, or what?
Well, I think it's a good development, you know. And the thing in music videos, it's a fabulous place to work because they're short films, right? So you can gamble on a look, on a technique And you just got to pull it off in 4 minutes.
Right.
So that's why I think it's been sort of a natural place to be the birthing ground for so many visual techniques and effects. You know, we can give it a go. First of all, when before that, we're urged to do something different, eye-catching and different. It's got to be. You know, it's like almost the rule that, you know, every music video has got to somehow go someplace. If it's going to be a great one, it's got to go someplace that you've never been before, you know. So we're always looking for something new. We're always looking for some way to make it cool and unique, right? So there's that. And then, like I said, because you only have to sustain it for 4 minutes, you know, at most, you know, you can gamble. You can roll the dice. You can't. You wouldn't want to try and totally pioneer a new technique and see if it works on a $10 million movie, you know, because if it doesn't work, it's $10 million out the window.
Yeah. But you were in the music, you were part of the music video revolution fairly early.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's, you know, it's kind of, it actually ties back to this, the purpose of this interview, or the main thread of this interview. There was a director in 1982. In 1982, the music video business was basically an English industry. There was a show, Old Grey Whistle Stop and Top of the Pops, and they knew that if you would put it was called a clip or a promo at that time. If you put a promo on, if you had a song in the top 10 in England or Australia, and you put a promo on the air, your album sales would go 5x the next week, and then 4x, 3x, 2x back to what you had before you started this.
Right.
So it was a pretty straight economic decision, financial decision, to produce a promo. Initially, that's how it started. And it was, like I said, an English industry. Well, an Australian director had gone to London, a guy named Russell Mulcahy. He actually directed the original Highlander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Russell was very much the man in music videos. He was doing, you know, Duran Duran and, you know, it just goes on and on, a list of great music videos he was doing. He was undisputedly the guy. Well, he was actually happened to be a huge Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan.
Mm.
And had a falling out with whoever was shooting for him over some reason, and all of a sudden needed a new cinematographer in Los Angeles, you know, in 2 days. I live in Los Angeles. The producer rang me up. This is Daniel Pearl. I mean, yeah, is this the Daniel Pearl who shot Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Yes. Well, Russell Mulcahy would love to, you know, have a meeting with you. So, now, this is virtually 10 years after I shot Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And in that time, I've been shooting sort of B-movies, principally is what I was doing with B-movies in Los Angeles. And we went off and made this music video. When it was done, he took me to a telecine machine, which is where we transfer the film to videotape, and so they can edit using video technique.
Yeah.
That's basically why music videos are called video, because that's where they did all their editing. And then took me to a party and introduced me to Godley and Cream, Steve Barron, you know, on and on, all the English directors. There happened to be a dozen of them at this party on Sunset. Mm-hmm. And they all just started hiring me right away. Next thing I was shooting Billie Jean, you know, Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, and The Police, Every Breath You Take. And it's just off and running. And it sucked, you know, cause I was fortunate to get good jobs, work with good directors, and what sort of made me unique was I was a guy who had been a filmmaker for 10 years. Most everybody else had about 2 or 3 years experience and was basically self-taught. So even though still I'm in my early 30s, I was like the film granddaddy to everybody, you know, so 10 years. He knows it all.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a great place to be. That was a fantastic time for me, and you know, the experimentation, the techniques, it's fabulous, and I still enjoy shooting music videos today.
Yeah, it amazes me, and I'm slightly in awe because you're such an essential part of cinematic history, and also music history. I mean, you think Michael Jackson, Billie Jean, The Police, Every Breath You Take, and all these tremendous talents that you've worked with in the area of music. I mean, you have to look back at your career so far and just, you must be in awe too.
A year ago, while I was shooting Alien vs. Predator, I was invited to go to Poland. There's a film festival there called Camera Image.
Yeah.
And that's a cinematography festival. So anybody out there, if you're interested in cinematography, this film festival takes place immediately after our Thanksgiving in a town called Łódź, south of Warsaw, Poland. And there's about 4,000 or 5,000 people that attend. And every year they give an award for the best photograph feature, the best photograph European feature, and the best photograph Polish feature. And then they give a lifetime achievement award to a cinematographer who's had an illustrious feature career, Owen Roizman, Wilmo Zsigmond, kind of guys, you know, won these awards in the past. Well, they contacted me and told me that they wanted to expand their festival. They wanted to open up short films into the festival. And when they discussed it, they said, well, really, the best short films are music videos. And then somehow they decided that they would bring this into their festival and kick it off by giving me a Lifetime Achievement Award for my music videos.
Mm.
So very honored, of course, and I was able to attend that. But the reason I told you all the story was they wanted me to cut together a 45-minute montage of my music videos, my greatest music videos. So I basically had to relive the previous 25 years of my life. It was really quite an incredible thing to go through because I had to, you know, get everything digital into Final Cut Pro, and then I was editing it while I was shooting Alien vs. Predator on my days off. And, boy, it really made me think, you know, I was forced to basically really relive my life in some ways, that there is the music video part of it.
Yeah, oh, well. Now, I can't let you go without asking about Alien vs. Predator. From a photography standpoint, I know that a lot of people are excited about this movie, me included. But obviously, it's a film that's steeped in kind of special effects. And how has special effects affected what you do? It's a whole different language, I'm sure you've had to learn.
Well, you know, first of all, I got to tell the audience out there, the film's directed by the brothers Strauss. It's Greg and Colin Strauss. They're very involved in visual effects. They're owners of a company called Hydraulix, one of the top visual effects companies in Hollywood, or actually technically in Santa Monica. And they absolutely were hired with that in mind. Having said that, once they got on the job, they wanted to do as much as possible in camera and reel, right? So they go, oh, man, we're visual effects, you know, CG up to our eyeballs. We're going to do as much as we can reel. And so, consequently, we did a lot. I mean, we had 11-week shoot, 53 days of shooting, I believe. And I think out of that, I spent 3 days in front of a green screen. Those of you who are technically aware of that, a green screen is basically a visual cookie cutter. We film people against a certain shade of green. They then tell a computer to cut what's not that color green out and stick it on top of another background. That might be probably CG. Or, you know, it's a way you make people fly. It's a way you put people in locations that they either can't get to or don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me for that explanation, but I thought that, that's not very much for a film of this type.
Yeah, yeah. That is surprising. We have a caller, and then that I promise I'll let you go. You've been so generous spending so much time with us.
Well, we
have someone on the line ask you a question. 757 area code. Go right ahead. 757.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey.
This is Jonathan Moody from the Independent Corner.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. I had a question for Daniel, if he doesn't mind.
No problem, go right ahead.
The question is, I noticed that since you've had such a great, like, extensive film background or whatever, are you ever thinking about directing a movie or doing anything other than just being a DP?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I did direct 3 music videos. I did, the first one I did was 4-page letter for Aaliyah. And then
mm-hmm.
I did Honey, Mariah
mm-hmm.
Carey, Honey the Remix, which is with, P. Diddy. And then I did, a butterfly for Mariah. In the end, there's several reasons about it. I'm really a shooter. That's what I do. My whole reason at that time that I directed was I wanted to have complete control of the camera. I wanted to take the best pictures that I could and shoot everything at the right time of day where the light was beautiful. And to do both, and also, every time I tried to hire another cameraman, my two clients, Aaliyah and Mariah, or their management, said, no way, you have to photograph the ladies. If you want, we'll hire another director. So basically, the coming out of that experience, you know, I realized that it's really what I do. I'm a shooter. I'm really good at that. And there's one other thing that I realized, that when I was trying to be a director, and I'm not really much of a writer, right? I'm a really good backseat driver, and that's, as a cinematographer, that's what you are. You're a co-collaborator with a director, and you work with him. And interestingly enough, you know, we as cinematographers, we work quite a bit, and we shoot a lot, and that's important to me. I like to shoot, and directors don't shoot as often, and that didn't appeal to me, the downtime in between the jobs as a director. And, you know, it didn't work out, but, you know, I don't think it'll ever happen, to be honest with you.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you so much for calling in with your question, man.
Okay, you have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Talk about it.
Mr. Pearl, thank you so much for spending so much time with us tonight. And
thank
I have
you.
So many more questions to ask you, but please join us again sometime in the near future. I just think you're welcome.
I'd be happy to join you. Thanks a lot, guys. It's been great.
Thank you so much, sir. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for joining us for Horror 101, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Join us tomorrow night when we examine The Blair Witch Project.